Okay, thank you. So this talk is going to be about some continued work in generalizing Kadama state. So let me give a brief introduction. So the Kadama state is unique in the sense that it's one of the only known solutions to all the constraints of quantum gravity that also has a well-defined semi-classical interpretation. In particular, semi-classical interpretation is that it represents a quantum version of familiar classical space-time, which is the Sitter space or anti-Sitter space, depending on the sign of the cosmological constant. Now, cosmological data suggests we're in an increasingly lambda-dominated universe, so our world appears to be asymptotically considered in the future as matter fields dilute and the cosmological constant becomes dominant. And it's also believed in the past, if you believe in inflation, then it was also very close to the Sitter. Okay. In addition, the state has a lot of nice mathematical properties. The exact form is known in the connection and in the spin network basis. So in the connection basis, it's Chernin-Simons, and spin network is the Kaufman bracket. So this realizes the exact realization of this connection between functionals on the space connections and spin network states. But it has a lot of problems. In particular, I'll mention a few. It's not normalizable under kinematical interproduct. It's not known to be normalizable under a physical interproduct. It is known from some of the people in the room that linearized solutions are not normalizable under a linearized interproduct. It's not invariant under CPT, which could be a big problem because there's a deep connection between Lorentz invariance and the CPT. And CPT invariance. And in addition, and possibly a more serious problem, is that CPT inverted states, so if you begin with the positive energy sector, it's been suggested that the CPT inverted states have negative energies. So it's never been shown whether the state actually has negative energies or not. Okay. It's not invariant under large gauge transformations. I should mention this could be a good thing. Been suggested by Lee and Chopin-Su that this property, this non-invariance under large gauge transformations, is what actually gives you thermal properties. But some people still worry about this. In addition, the loop transform and complex variables, it's not as rigorous as with real variables. And in addition, reality constraints still have to be implemented, and that could change a lot. So let me give an outline. So the problems with the state, you can track them back to, they stem from the complexification necessary in constructing the state. You have to complexify the space space. In turn, the complexification comes from a particular choice of the emergency parameter, where the emergency parameter is plus or minus I. So you get self-dual solutions, self-dual or anti-self-dual. So this suggests a resolution. Let's try to extend the state to real values of the emergency parameter and see what happens. So what I want to show is that this can be done, and the answer is surprising. It solves most of the problems, the standard problems associated with the state, but it also opens up a large Hilbert space of states. And I also want to show that the existence of the state actually stems from a deep connection with an underlying local de Sitter symmetry, and it's not because of a self-dual condition. And that I'll show from a connection with MacDowell-Mansuri formalism, and this will also suggest a possible freedom from gauge tracing. So to construct the state, I want to actually begin with, let's start with a review of the Kadama state. Okay, so we begin with the left-handed part of the Lorentz group. So Lorentz group splits into two components. Just choose one component. And the action you start with is the Einstein-Cartan action for the left-handed part of the curvature with the cosmological constant. Okay. The dynamical variables are the SC2-Ashtakar connection. Its conjugate momentum is just a two-form E wedge G, surface two-form. Okay. And in the connection representation, A is just multiplicative. Sigma here is a functional derivative. Okay. Hamiltonian constraint can be written as follows. All right. And this property of the Chern-Simons invariant that its functional derivative is just the curvature. Okay, the state and the Hamiltonian constraint annihilates this state by virtue of it being in the kernel of this operator. And it can be shown that this state's unique in Lorentzian signature. It's generally interpreted as De Sitter space, but I should say the reality constraints still have to be implemented. And that may change a lot. Okay, so now I want to go through the construction of generalized states. And what I'm going to do is actually start with an arbitrary imaginary value of the Mercer parameter, and later analytically extend to real values. And the reason for doing that is because arbitrary imaginary values can be viewed as a measure of specifically chiral asymmetry built into the action. Okay? And the way to see that is here's the Holst action. It's the foundation, the starting point for Lipkin gravity. Mercer parameter is 1 over theta. We can split the action. If theta is imaginary, we can split this action into two components, one left-handed, one right-handed. Alpha left and alpha right don't have to be equal. The sum has to be 1. But then we can identify the Mercer parameter in terms of these two coupling constants. Okay. So what I want to do is begin the quantization assuming the left and right-handed pieces are independent, and then later impose this primary constraint that the two momenta are actually equal to each other, and they both happen to be equal to u I g. Okay, so here's our canonical commutation relations. Notice we're treating the left and the right as independent. Okay. Then the constraints split into two left and right pieces, and immediately we have this generalization of the Church-Simon state. So it has a left-handed piece and a right-handed piece. Now we need to impose this constraint that sigma left minus sigma right is equal to 0. Okay, so this constraint has a lot of implications. For one thing, if you take the commutator of this constraint with the Hamiltonian, you get a second class constraint, which tells you the torsion has to be 0, the three torsion. Okay. So in principle, we could solve this. We solve this just by setting the torsion equal to 0. The spin connection just becomes the Levi-Civitas connection. But now left and right pieces won't commute. So that's our first indication that something might go wrong. Another indication, all right, we can define these new variables. I'm going to define A of 1 over beta just to be gamma plus 1 over beta k. A of beta, this is the Ashtekar-Barbera connection. Okay. And I'm going to define sigma as just the sum of the two pieces, the left and right pieces. The reason for defining this is now the conjugate momentum to A of 1 over beta is our constraint C. Okay. And sigma now is the conjugate momentum to the Ashtekar-Barbera connection. So now in the connection representation, the functional derivative of the wave function with respect to A1 over beta has to be equal to 0, since C is 0. That's the constraint. Okay, so the wave function can only be a function of the Barbera connection, and not of this other piece. So now we want to check that our state is actually in the kernel of C. And what we're going to do is write the state in terms of these new variables. And I'm going to write it in a suggested form that will be useful later. But what we can see is this first piece is OK. The second piece, gamma, you can write specifically as a function of both these variables. And k is also a function of gamma. Okay. And it doesn't work. The wave function is intrinsically a function of both variables. So we have a problem, so how do we resolve this? Well, let's start by recasting the problem. If we can recast the problem, at this point, let's forget about the A of 1 over beta. The real problem is the wave function is both a functional of the position variable and the momentum variable. Okay. The momentum variable occurs in these gamma functions. So the solution I want to suggest is that we analytically extend to realize the Mercy parameter. And then what we're going to do is reinterpret the role of this momentum dependence. Okay. So the reinterpretation is that the generalized Kadama states for realized Mercer parameter are very similar to the non-relativistic momentum eigenstates. Okay. So let me, so again, this is our state. All right. I'm going to rewrite it in this form. I'm pulling out all the irrelevant factors into a phase factor. And now we can identify variables. The position variable x in the momentum state is like A. The momentum variable is now like Webby-Chivitar curvature R. Okay. We have dimensionless energy, and the time is identified with the Chern-Simons functional. And I should note this has been independent. It's been independently suggested that the Chern-Simons functional is a natural time variable on the configuration space. So now it appears that we have this infinite set of states that are parameterized by the curvature.
So, the relationship of this guy and the previous one, how did it go on this?
What's that?
The relationship between this psi r of gamma, it's unrelated or it's related to the previous?
It's related. It is the previous. It's just rewritten.
Okay, there was some extra
terms. Yeah, there's an extra term, but I pulled those out to the front. The extra term that you might be worried about is this one. But notice, I mean, if this thing's, this, the idea is that this is just a classical parameter. So now it's just a real number. We pull that out to the front. It's just a phase factor, actually. Okay, so we have this infinite set of states parameterized by the curvature, just like the momentum eigenstates. And because of that, we expect that the different curvature states will be orthogonal in the following sense. Okay, momentum states are delta function orthogonal. We can also define an inner product between these two states. Notice this term just drops out because it's pure phase. Okay. And we can formally integrate over all values of the connection. We get as an infinite dimensional delta function between the two curvatures. Okay. So inner product is zero unless the two curvatures are equal. Now there's some problems with this inner product. Obviously, if r prime and r are related, are actually the same curvature, just written in a different gauge, this will still give you zero. So we need to make this gauge at least covariant. Okay. So let's address that problem. Well, let's look at how the states actually transform under an SU2 transformation or a diffeomorphism transformation. It turns out they're not actually invariant under them. And the reason is you see the same problem with spin network states. Spin network states aren't invariant under diffeomorphisms because if you shift the connection and keep the graph fixed, that's equivalent to shifting the graph and keeping the connection fixed. Okay. But because of this property, we can group average, and you can come up with a diffeomorphism invariant inner product. And that's basically the idea we're going to do. That's the same trick we're going to use here. Notice that in this case, phi represents a diffeomorphism and an SU2 gauge transformation. Acting on the state, that's explicitly it acts on the connection configuration. But that's equivalent to acting backwards on the curvature. So the curvature R essentially acts like a background. But because of this property, now we can group average to define this gauge invariant inner product by integrating over all values of diffeomorphisms and SU2 transformations. And we still get a delta function. Okay. Now these script R's represent equivalence classes of curvatures, modulo, diffeomorphisms, and SU2 transformations. Okay. So we have shown that these states are normalizable, the delta function normalizable. I haven't said it yet, but they are actually invariant. They can be made to be invariant under large gauge transformations because they're pure phase, which means that the level of the Chern-Simons theory is real. And by fine-tuning the coupling constants, you can make it invariant under large gauge transformations. OK, so now, we can actually define a Levy-Chivitar curvature operator in the same way that we define a momentum operator. Okay? Just take this projection operator, multiply by a p, integrate over all values of p. Then, using the properties, the delta function normalizability of the momentum eigenstates, these eigenstates are now, well, they're eigenstates, p, this operator. In the same way, we can construct a gauge covariant curvature operator. So what we need to do now is introduce a test function lambda. So here's lambda. The only reason for doing this is we want not a pointwise curvature operator, but something that holds over the full manifold. Okay. We have to integrate over all diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations. D gamma prime, that's just an appropriate measure to integrate over all values of the curvature. Okay? But otherwise, this operator has the same form. And now, using the inner product of the two states, we find that these states are now eigenstates of the Levi-Chebyshov curvature.
So it's like our emission under this scalar product?
Yeah. So eigenvalues are all good.
Sorry, yeah, I have a question here. So if you take the right hand side, you define the number A2. Mm-hmm. Let's call it R1. Mm-hmm. But now R of gamma is a function of E of the Wiervine field. So it's also somehow independently defined as an operator acting on Schrodinger function of A. Mm-hmm. So at this stage, it is an assumption that this definition of R of gamma is.
Absolutely, it's still an assumption. What I want to convince you of is that it's a good curvature operator. For one thing, it's gauge covariant. It has right transformation properties under gauge transformations, things like that. But I think the next step will help. I mean, some of this stuff may look circular, but the nice thing is the circle closes. We'll see in a second. Okay? Okay. So now, we can address this issue of the Hamiltonian constraint as follows. Okay, here's a standard representation of the Hamiltonian constraint. These k's are very difficult operators to define. There's another representation I'll call it Ricci minus Ricci. It's a terrible joke, but the reason is because it's the difference of two curvature tensors, one for the Riemann tensor and one for this curvature path. Now the point is, if we now use the curvature operator, which we defined in the previous slide, then all the states are actually in the kernel of this Hamiltonian by virtue of being in the kernel of this operator itself. So these things always have to be filled up.
That's a calculation.
Yeah, I'm not going to show it. It's fairly simple to see, though. A piece of chalk.
It should be a box of chalk.
Here we go. Yeah, so the state looks something like this. Di integral A wedge R minus some factors. I'm not going to get them quite right, but it looks basically like this. Okay. Now, when you hit this thing, the connection representation is a functional derivative. So when you hit this thing, you pull down a factor R minus some appropriate factors of the curvature F of the function A. Okay. Well, this piece right here, this F cancels out with this piece. Okay. And what we're left with now is an R hat minus this value of the curvature R operating on psi. Okay. Now what we use is the fact that these states are supposed to be eigenstates of the curvature operator, but so you get an R minus R. That gives you zero.
Okay. So the states only satisfy the integrators and the Hamiltonian constraint?
I would say so. I think so.
So it wouldn't satisfy if I mean.
Well, actually, no, that's not true. I think it would satisfy even without the integral, I think it would still satisfy.
Well, then.
So it would satisfy it point-wise.
So it satisfies point-wise. Mm-hmm. Then you get a problem if the state satisfies point-wise and the Hamiltonian constraints. It should
satisfy. Okay, well, maybe we can talk about this later, but
yeah, if you don't have anomalies, then from the Fourier identity from the Dirac algebra also constraint, you can see the state satisfies all the Hamiltonian constraints, which is not
possible.
That's the ordering issue. There's certainly orbits in which it's not true because the right-hand side of the commutator of the Hamiltonian constraint says it diffeomorphizes and then the non-graded to the right one. Anyway, it's...
Well, maybe we can talk about it. Okay. Okay, so now we've shown the solid Hamiltonian constraint. Now let's talk about the semi-classical interpretation. We want these things to represent the Sitter space. So do they look like something like the Sitter space? And the answer is yes. The reason is because we can interpret them as WKB states corresponding to the Sitter space and possibly beyond. The way you do that is to start with the Holst action. Okay? All solutions to the vacuum field equations look like this. The first order of WKB state is found by taking these equations of motion, putting them back in here, okay, and then the state is e to the I S0, where S0 is the action evaluated on the equation of motion. So when you do that, by the way, this C is the vital curvature tensor. When you do that, I'm going to assume that the vital tensor is small, so dropping all C squared terms, the action becomes topological. This is it. This is the Euler characteristic. This is the second Turing class. Okay. Now I'm going to take the boundary of the manifold to be a space-like hypersurface. Set the three torsion to zero. Okay, that's one of the equations of motion. And what I find is that S0 becomes this. Okay. And that's precisely the argument of these generalized Cardano states. So what we have is an exact WKB state. Both exact and it's WKB. Okay, so we've shown that these states contain the Sitter space and possibly these first order perturbations to this Sitter space. So the question now becomes, which one is the Sitter? Right? So what I'd like to say, there is a slicing of the Sitter space in which three curvature is flat, so R is equal to zero. And in that slicing, the spatial topology is R3. So this Cardano state takes a special form when R equals zero. So we take the spatial topology to be R3. We look for the eigenstate of the curvature operator with R equals zero. And this is the state. Okay, so this is a specific state. And it happens to have it happens to be the only state in that full class which is identically SC2 and diffeomorphism in there. So there's some nice things you can see from this. There's evidence of the cosmological horizon. And you see that from the loop transformation. The Q-deform loop expansion of the state is well known. So gamma represents a spin network with edges labeled in some representation of the quantum group SQQ2, then that loop expansion is just, the coefficients are just the Kaufman bracket. Okay. And the parameter is this Q, where the deformation parameter Q is, well, it's given by this. And K kappa is related to G, cosmological constant, and emergency parameter Q. So now, at roots of unity, so when this thing is a root of unity, the representations of the quantum group, they terminate after a certain order. Okay. The spectrum of the area operator actually terminates as well. We get the maximum value for the area operator. And it's on the order of the de Sitter radius. The de Sitter area. But there's a new effect that you can see from this, actually. It's that the Mertz parameter appears to be significant not only at very small areas where it's proportional to beta, so for small areas, it's proportional to the Mertz parameter, but for large areas, it seems to go like 1 over beta squared. Okay. So we've shown it has a semi-classical interpretation. I'm going to go quickly over CPT invariants. So the way to do this is to notice, first, CPT has an action both in the base manifold and in the SO31 representation space. It's useful to use a mixture of both these three-dimensional, four-dimensional forms. The action of CPT is well known on the Clifford algebra, so it's useful to use the Clifford algebra notation. And notice the state actually uses two different interproducts on the Clifford algebra. It uses this ordinary interproduct and then the star interproduct. From those properties, one can show that the state is CPT invariant, but it's not CP invariant. So charge conjugation doesn't do anything, which we'd expect, since gravitons are their own antiparticles. Parity inverts the emergency parameter, but time inverts it back. So the state is parity violating only insofar as the original action we started with is parity violating. Okay, so now, so we've shown that CPT invariant. Now, how about negative energies? Well, we still don't know about negative energies, but I will say this. In the original form of the Cardano state, the reason why it wasn't CPT invariant is because the state was actually a product of positive energy, positive velocity states, with negative energy, negative velocity states. Under CPT, positive energy states were inverted to negative energy states. And that's why it was not CPT invariant. I will say, so now, this is CPT invariant, so that doesn't appear to be what's going on. But we still don't know. OK, now I want to talk about the relation between a more physical interproduct and the McDowell-Mansuri formulation of gravity. So the kinematical interproduct we define is unlikely to be the true interproduct. True interproduct is generally defined by path integral methods. So what you do is you take these two states to be defined on two different time slices and take a unitary evolution between those two states. Unitary evolution is defined by the path integral. So we have the two states defined on the n-caps, and path integral of the action defines the evolution. Now, because these two states are the boundary states of topological action, we can write them like this. Okay? And what we're fixing on the two end caps are the two geometries which give us these two curvatures, r prime and r. So what I claim is that this is related to the McDowell-Mansuri formulation of gravity. So to see that, let's do a little bit of review. So McDowell-Mansuri begins with this Sitter connection. That means is we have to add a new connection coefficient. R0 is now just related to cosmological constants, cosmological radius. And the curvature is the ordinary spin connection curvature, SO31 curvature, plus torsion, plus this additional cosmological term. With that, the McDowell-Mansuri action ends up being this. This star actually breaks the Sitter invariants. When it breaks the Sitter invariants, what you get is an Einstein-Cartan action plus the cosmological constant with this topological term. So this is a little bit familiar now. Now we have to add the emergency parameter to this formalism, and that's easy to do. Essentially, all you do is adding the emergency parameter is obtained by deforming the curvature by its dual. So let's see if we can do the same thing. So let's deform F by its dual.
What does it mean? So it's theta star F.
Theta star F? Well, so there's a little bit of a complication. The star actually projects you into an SO31 subspace. And then you take the dual in the SO31 subspace. So this thing does actually break the Sitter invariants as well. Specifically, star is gamma 5.
Star is OK. So if this were written in a four-dimensional spin representation of SO5, then star would be gamma 5.
Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah, so these traces, there's a gamma 5 there, gamma 5 there, and one there. So what happens when you do that? So this is our new action with the curvature by its dual. What do we get? Well, so the McDowell-Mansuri action with the emergency parameter now becomes the Einstein-Cartan action with the cosmological constant and the right emergency parameter term. Okay. plus these topological terms. But that should be familiar, because that is exactly the argument of the Cardano state in this four-dimensional representation. So what we've now shown is that, going back here, remember, that term actually showed up here in the inner product between two states, because this is actually the product of the two states right there. So what we've shown is that this exact combination of variables occurs in the MacDowell-Mansuri formulation. So the MacDowell-Mansuri formulation actually has those proper topological terms. So the inner product of the two states is related to the vacuum partition function of MacDowell-Mansuri formulation, where you're fixing actually the geometries on the two end caps. And those geometries give you these two curvatures, R prime and R. Okay, so this inner product of two Cardano states is equivalent to a Hawking sum over histories in MacDowell-Mansuri gravity. Now we can say the difference between Einstein-Cartan gravity and MacDowell-Mansuri gravity is that the latter actually contains these Cardano states that are already built in to begin with. So this is similar to the two formulations of the CP problem in Yang-Mills theory. Either the states can have this theta ambiguity, where under a large gauge transformation, they have this theta ambiguity. Or you can normalize away all the states by multiplying by this appropriate factor, the Chern-Simons invariant, e to the I theta y Chern-Simons. Okay, and that'll give that now the states won't have this theta ambiguity, but as a consequence, those factors will crop up again in the action. And the action will have to be modified by an F wedge F term. So the same thing appears to be going on here. Okay, so now we have this relation to the true inner product of MacDowell-Mansuri gravity. Last, I want to suggest a possible freedom from gauge fixing that's suggested by the states. So freedom from gauge fixing. The gauge fixing I'm talking about is working in the time gauge, where you project the gauge group from the Lorentz group down to SC2 subgroup. So it'd be nice if we could free ourselves from that gauge fixing for a variety of reasons. For one thing, spin foam formalism, essentially it's supposed to glue two canonical states. Spin foam is the glue that binds those two together and gives you an inner product. But spin foams, there's no need to gauge fix, and it's a lot easier to do without gauge fixing. Canonical formalism, we do have to gauge fix, so we have this problem of gluing the two states together. So that's one thing. And there's just, in general, I feel like a lot of people do, that I'm a little bit uneasy by the fact that we're gauge fixing and we don't see explicit Lorentz covariance. So this WKB state prior to gauge fixing, this state, generalized Cardano state prior to gauge fixing, is suggests that maybe we could actually come up with this state without gauge fixing. Okay. So can one obtain this from the canonical construction without fixing to the time gauge? What I say is that we can obtain a slightly modified version of the state. So what I'm going to do is begin with a modified version of the Holst action. So this is a new modification, T wedge T. And it's a very slight modification in the sense that this term is actually the ordinary emergency term plus the topological term, the Ni and Yang class. So this actually gives you a canonical transformation on the phase space. The new variables end up being a position variable, spin connection omega, with its conjugate momentum sigma, okay? Where sigma is defined by this primary constraint, the dual E wedge E. And there's another position variable, E, which comes from this piece, T wedge T. Its conjugate momentum is actually the torsion. And it also has a primary constraint that the torsion is equal to dE. And the reason I think this might work is because this primary constraint, well, notice this is just a position variable. So this is constraint on some dynamical variables already, so it may be easy to implement. Okay. So
So now the symplectic structure defines this Poisson bracket. We have the ordinary, this piece, the omega, the sigma piece, but we also have an infinite portion piece. So the naive constraints prior to gauge fixing, by naive I mean prior, prior to implementing these primary constraints. These are, well, there's a diffeomorphism constraint. Okay. What I'm doing is I'm splitting up time into a component normal to the foliation and a component parallel. So the end is just a shift, it's normal. So that generates gauge transformations, so we have to have this extra piece in here to generate diffeomorphisms on the E itself. There's a Gauss constraint, and it generates ordinary SO3-1 transformation. Notice we haven't fixed the gauge group, so alpha is actually a Lie element of the Lie algebra of SO3-1 itself. Okay. So this defines the transformation properties of omega under a gauge transformation. And E is tensorial, so it just gets a commutator. Now, the Hamiltonian constraint is a little bit weird. It's weird only because we haven't gauge fixed. So eta here is now a 4-vector. So the Hamiltonian constraint is not a scalar constraint at all. It actually has 4 components. Okay. And this is what it looks like. This is an ordinary piece. We also have this torsion piece as well. And you'll see in a second why eta has to be a 4-vector. Okay, so now what we need to do is compute the constraint algebra. So let's start with the Gauss and the Hamiltonian constraints. Poisson algebra. So the algebra between two Gauss constraints ends up being another Gauss constraint. Notice this is isomorphic to the Lie algebra of SO3-1, which we'd expect because the Gauss constraint just generates SO3-1 gauge transformations. Okay, now the commutator of two Hamiltonians, this is a little bit surprising. Now, eta is a 4-vector. Commutator of two Hamiltonians ends up giving you another Gauss constraint. And the parameter is actually the commutator of eta 1 and eta 2. Okay, so this is something new. How about the commutator of a Gauss constraint and a Hamiltonian? Well, that just gives you another Hamiltonian. And the parameter is just this commutator. Okay. So something very nice just happened. Well, first of all, these naive constraints close. But secondly, this is actually isomorphic to a Lie algebra. In particular, this is the Lie algebra for the De Sitter group. You add diffeomorphisms, nothing really changes. Algebra is just isomorphic to the Lie algebra of the semi-direct product of the De Sitter group with diffeomorphisms, 3 dimensions. Okay. So this is nice. Because of this property, we can actually solve all these constraints. The hope is that this might do for the canonical constraint algebra what BF theory does for spin foam models, in the sense that you start with a topological theory. It's topological in the sense that the local evolution here is just pure gauge, it's the sitter gauge. And then you constrain it later. In this case, we have to implement the primary constraints.
So, do they have it from the constraints of the same interpretation as in the usual theory that they generate deformations of the hypersurface?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I don't know. It's not obvious that they would, but I think they do, actually. But I'm not certain about that. I think they do in the sense that the local evolution along the time direction can actually be thought of as a De Sitter transformation, one of these pseudo-transformations in De Sitter algebra. I'm not certain about that, but I think that's what's going on.
Can I ask you a big question? The Hamiltonian constraint depended on a 4-vector, not on the last structure, if I understood.
Yeah, okay.
So does that mean that you haven't projected the time direction into... So I'm confused about that, because when you said t is eta plus n, usually
eta is n.
Is not n. is some function kind of t-defined number.
Well, so to get the ordinary algebra, you just have to set eta equal to lapsed times the normal.
Right.
Okay. Now, the key is, when you gauge fix, working the time gauge means you fix normal to be a point in one particular direction. The remainder of the transformations that leave this vector fixed, can you see that?
Yeah.
The remainder of the vectors, the remainder of the transformations that leave that fixed are just rotations. So this actually fixes, gauge fixes, it reduces you to an SF2 subgroup. We're not doing that here, so you don't actually need to decompose it like this.
Right, so my memory is that the result of time point that you get the standard Hamiltonian constraint algebra into different morphisms is a consequence of that. And it may give you a vape.
Okay.
Because I don't know if this is.
So there's a general argument. If you have a generators which generate hypersurface deformation, then you have always the Dirac algebra, which means that the Hamiltonian constraint should give you the commutator of the Hamiltonian constraint should give you the critical amount of the constraint.
But it doesn't happen in 2 plus 1, and I think it doesn't happen in 2 plus 1. Because you don't make the projection before you plot that, because you gauge the whole Lorentz group. And anyway, this requires one step, but maybe you evade that the same, you evade the title problem result for the same reason.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about it later again. Okay, so now I said because of this property, I can actually solve all these constraints. Let me show you how. So in the connection representation, now connection and the tetrad representation, so omega and e are both going to be multiplicative operators. Sigma is just a functional derivative. T is also a functional derivative. Okay. So now the wave function is functional both of omega and of e. So we can actually solve these. I can actually find lots of solutions. So I'll just give you one. This is the solution. Okay. Notice this is exactly the state that we want. There's an additional piece, but that's not surprising at all, because we began with an action that differed from the Holst action precisely by the Niemann class, which is this term. The remaining piece is actually just this ordinary generalized Cadan state. And this state actually just work through it explicitly. It satisfies all the constraints.
And then you want to impose on these your primary constraints?
Yes. Yeah. So now I want to impose the primary constraints. Okay, so how do I do that? Well, so the primary constraints say that for any functional f, a position and momentum, okay, so e omega, sigma, and t, that functional has to be the same functional with all sigmas replaced by star e by g and all t's replaced by t e. So the idea is, if this holds on the constraint submanifold, it will also hold on any function of the constraint submanifold. So what we need is to define this on the constraints themselves. So let's define a new C prime, which is only going to be a function of omega and e, to be the old constraint C, explicitly written in terms of star u by g and b.
So all your constraints are first class?
I believe so. I haven't computed all of them. Everything I've calculated so far has. Let me say this. I mean, schematically, what it looks like is this. Schematically, we have two C's. So the commutator of two C's, we did all these, and ended up being just another C. Commutator of a C with C prime with a C prime, those are all just position variables, so that has to give you zero. No function derivative with respect to momentum. Commutator with a C prime, it ends up being another C prime. Looks schematically like that. Okay, so now the basic idea is we need to impose this constraint that C prime is equal to zero. So now, the point is this. Now, since C prime is a it's a constraint only on position variables. Essentially, this gives you relations between omega and E. We can implement this through the inner product. And the idea is this. Implement it, integrate over all values of omega and all values of E, throw in a delta function of the constraint itself, and here's your two wave functions. So now let's represent that delta function as follows. Represent the delta function by integrating over all values of these parameters. Eta, the SU2 generator, SO31 generators, and the last. And then when you do that on these generalized Kadama states, okay, just let this delta function, let these constraints do what constraints do. They evolve you from one hypersurface to the next. Okay. What this does when we insert this into here is this reproduces the MacDonald-Mansuri partition function. So we're getting the same qualitative behavior. Okay. Okay, so now we've talked about freedom from gauge variance. I put a question mark here because this is still pretty, it's still in its infancy. So let me conclude with some open problems. Here's just a few. The loop transform, well, we know that the Sitter solution is the Kaufman bracket. The other solutions, do they generalize? I don't know. There's a slicing issue. What happens under a change of spatial topology? Do the states change to accommodate for that? So, for example, take the De Sitter solution. It looks like Chern-Simons. If I change the topology from R3 to S3, I should pick up a factor of the curvature. Because in the S3 slicing, we have constant curvature. But does that actually happen? I don't know. How about thermal arguments? Okay, so for it's been argued that for the original form of the Kadama state, these large gauge transformations actually imply a KMS condition, which gives you these thermal properties of the Sitter space. It's not clear at all that this will work in our case, because they are actually invariant in their large SU2 gauge transformations. So can one use some argument to fix the Mertz parameter using this type of form question? I don't know. And also, what's the relation between the states with gauge fixing and the states without? On the one hand, we've got this infinite class of states. On the other hand, we just have one state. Our state was this. So what is the connection there? It's possible that the connection actually comes in through here, where when you define the inner product, you might have to fix some boundary information. But it's not clear to me exactly how that works. And it's also possible, I should mention, that these states, even though we appear to have this infinite class of states, it's possible that some of these states, if not all of them, might be related to Lorentz symmetry. So they might actually form, say, an infinite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group.
Do you have any deeper ideas behind this infrared ultraviolet mixing that seems to come out?
You'll have to explain to me what that is. So,
well, the fact that the Mirzi parameter shows up in the ultraviolet as well as in the infrared.
Right, yeah. So I don't know.
That somehow it seems to me that, that there is a quite deep mixing between ultraviolet and infrared.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, I don't have anything intelligent to say about that, but I'd like to figure that out. Yeah,
it should somehow have something to do with the fact with the relation to the McGowan-Mansuri formulation, I guess, right? Because of the Sitter invariance.
Maybe. I don't see how that. It's not clear. I mean, Macdonald surrogate, you can formulate independent data that doesn't seem to make a difference, at least classically. So,
If you're right, there's a lot of very, very interesting ideas and hypotheses here. But if you're right that the physical inner product is implemented by the Macdonald answer, as you said, could you set up a calculation where you started with your state, which is semi-classical de Sitter, plus some linearized wave on de Sitter, such as first order in the bowel curvature to represent the graviton, and the final state to represent something could be interpreted as a graviton, this is going to first order. Could you then use your hypothesis to write down path interval to that acute graviton scattering there?
So that's an interesting idea. So what you could do is just take a very small perturbation to the curvature and just compute compute this path integral in the Macdonald Tsuri formulas, and what you should get is gravitons in the Sitter space itself, if this interpretation is right. So that's a good way of checking it. Maybe using some of the machinery that you and Laurent introduced in one of your papers, something like that might be possible. I haven't thought about it, but.
So I have another question. So many things depend on the fact that you have defined some conjugation of Semi-Tonin constraint operator, which seems to be a bit circular. So you try some consistency check. And one consistency check would be actually to look at the constraint algebra of these.
So that's a good point. You should do some consistency checks. My hope was that the consistency check I'm going to go through is actually this gauge invariant formalism. So if I get similar results using this gauge invariant formalism where the operator makes sense, I don't have to do this nasty thing of defining this operator R, where R is explicitly a function of these operators. If I can get around that and get similar results, if I can get around it by not gauge fixing and get similar results, then that would be a consistency check in my mind. No, it's a very good point. I haven't done any consistency checks, but it should be.
I got another question. Do you now have, since you now have that, the field lines seem to be the momentum of the torsion.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So do you now have propagating torsion in your theory?
No, it's not propagating. Actually, it began with is actually non-propagating.
Classically it's non-propagating. But
So in
theory, it's still the fact that you have a momentum for the torsion, it doesn't do anything. It's just kinematical, stays kinematical.
I can't think of any reason why torsion would propagate quantum mechanically, but not classically. But
since it now has a momentum, right, somehow.
But the momentum just generates shifts in heat. And the wave function now has to be a functional of E itself, so it just tells you how the wave function itself behaves when you change E to E plus something else. And that in turn is related to de Sitter transformation. It's not really propagating torsion. The torsion really just generates a particular de Sitter transformation.
Let's take any name.